Hi, it's me, Evan. Really quick before we start today's show, twice a year we shorten the show so we can spend some time asking listeners like you to pledge your support to Good Food. Since you're listening via podcast, you might not have heard me and my colleagues on air asking for your dollars or even know that the show is produced by a public radio station. So here's my quick pitch to you. If you love Good Food, and why else would you be listening via podcast, then show us your support by becoming a member of our station, KCRW, today. You can even do it right now. If you're by your computer or your iPad, go to kcrw.com/join. If you're in the car, pull over, pause this message, and dial 1-800-600-KCRW. That's 1-800-600-5279. If you've pledged before, it's a great time to renew your monthly membership. We depend on you to support us, just like you depend on us for weekly restaurant reviews from Jonathan Gold or all the recipes we share on the Good Food blog. If you've heard me say it before and you didn't act, don't miss your chance this time. Go to kcrw.com/join and support KCRW as a monthly member. Or you can do what I do and pledge as an angel and take part in our cookbook club. That's a dollar a day to support the programming that you love. Whatever amount you give, I personally want to say thanks so much. Now, let's get back to the show. From KCRW and kcrw.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I'll go not too far out on a limb and say that we Californians probably eat more salads in aggregate than anyone else in the world. But what exactly are we eating? The same combos topped with the same family dressing as always? To give us a bit of a tune-up, I have a ringer. Kenji Lopez-Alt, known as the entertaining nerd behind the Food Lab column at Serious Eats. I have a feeling that from now on, he will be known as the guy who wrote the engaging yet serious reference book, The Food Lab, which just won a James Beard Award. Hi, Kenji.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What a book. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Let's start with the burning question I have about salad dressing. I like to use olive oil, and often I emulsify it in a Vitamix before tossing it in my salad. Am I making a mistake?
Well, olive oil is extremely reactive, and so when you put olive oil inside a blender or anything that's going to really spin it with a lot of vigorous force, some of the molecules actually shear, and they oxidize much faster, so it'll completely change the flavor of the olive oil. And you can try this even if you're not making a salad dressing. Just take like a half cup of olive oil, put it in a blender, and let it run for about 15 seconds, and then taste that side by side with fresh olive oil from the bottle, and you'll find that the one that went through the blender is really, really bitter. So olive oil, I recommend never putting it in a blender or anything, or food processor or blender or anything that's going to really spin it vigorously, because it's going to make it turn bitter.
So given that advice, when do we decide when we really need to emulsify? And when we really need to use olive oil, because I noticed that in some of your dressings where you're emulsifying, you're using different kinds of vegetable oils.
If you're talking just about a basic vinaigrette, you can form an emulsion that's tight enough that it'll cling to your lettuce and your greens, you know, just by hand. You can put it in a jar and shake it, or you can whisk it up together. If you're talking about something more heavily emulsified, like a mayonnaise, for example, that's when you do need to use the blender. When I make my mayonnaise, if I wanted to have a really strong olive oil flavor, I'll actually start it with a neutral oil like canola or vegetable oil, maybe some grapeseed oil, something with a very neutral flavor. And I'll do that in the blender or with a hand blender just until it starts to come together. And then I'll transfer it into a bowl and whisk in the olive oil. But you never want to put the olive oil directly into the blender. You always want to add the olive oil by hand.
Have you discovered in all of your extreme experimentation, is there a golden ratio of vinegar to oil?
There is, yes. You know, you can do anywhere from 2-to-1 to about 3-to-1. You want 2 parts to 3 parts oil to every part of vinegar or lemon juice or your water-based liquid. The reason you want to form an emulsion in a salad dressing, you go to those Italian restaurants and they give you the bottle of oil and vinegar on the side on your table. And that's the worst way you can dress a salad. Salad greens and actually all leaves have a sort of waxy cuticle on them. And that's so that when it rains, you know, the rainwater just runs right off of them. Vinegar and other water-based liquids like lemon juice actually don't really cling to greens very well. They run right off and they end up in the bottom of your bowl. On the other hand, olive oil or any kind of oil sticks very well to greens. And if you've ever seen your salad wilting, it's not the vinegar that's causing it to wilt. It's actually the oil that's causing it to wilt because that seeps through that waxy cuticle, gets into the cells, and causes it to wilt. By forming a tight emulsion, and that's, you know, when you get the oil and the vinegar, two things that don't normally mix very well, when you get them to mix together, it clings to the leaves in the same way that oil can, but it doesn't penetrate as much, so your salad won't wilt as fast, but it also gets that vinegar to stick to the greens. That's the reason you want to form a really tight emulsion before you toss your salad. It, you know, it makes it more vinegary, but it also gets it to stick to the greens. You want to look for a ratio of about 2:1 to 3:1, and that's going to form the sort of tightest emulsion that you can get.
So you just totally blew out of the water everyone who's been making their salad in the traditional Italian way, where first oil, fluff,
right,
then vinegar, fluff, then salt.
If you're going to eat your salad very, very fast and you're going to, you know, you're doing it right at the table and you're going to just put it on your plate and immediately eat it, then it's an okay way to do it because, you know, the vinegar doesn't have a lot of time or the lemon juice doesn't have a lot of time to drip off the greens. But you will get better flavor and better adhesion to the greens if you actually form your vinaigrette separately and then toss the salad with it. And your greens will also last longer. They won't wilt as fast.
I understand your wife is kind of challenged when it comes to making the vinaigrette recipes that the two of you love at home, and you've come up with a solution that I think is kind of genius and you should sell.
Yeah, it's super simple. This is like my trick for eating more salads. Making a salad, the most annoying part is making that vinaigrette and having to pull out all those little bottles and mincing the shallots and doing, you know, all the things that require making vinaigrette. So what I do is I buy empty plastic squeeze bottles, and I draw lines on the side of the bottle with a Sharpie. And those lines indicate how far I have to fill it up. So there's a line at like the halfway mark that says olive oil. Then there's a line about a third of the way up from there that says vinegar. And then it'll list a couple of the other ingredients. It'll say like one dollop mustard, one minced shallot, and salt and pepper, for instance. And that way you don't need to pull out measuring spoons. You don't need to weigh anything. You just fill the bottle to where the line is whenever it runs out. And then you can shake it up directly in the bottle to emulsify it and then squeeze it onto your salad. And it's super easy.
We've been talking about dressings, and we touched on mayonnaise, and we've been talking about vinaigrettes, but then there's the dairy-based dressing.
Right, and that's going to be things like a blue cheese dressing or like a buttermilk ranch dressing. Those are ones that actually are quite simple to make because dairy is almost always an emulsion to begin with. So heavy cream, buttermilk, milk, they are all already fat and water emulsions. So it makes a very easy base for a dressing.
Is there kind of a magic emulsifier that you can add to a vinaigrette, something like mustard maybe?
Yeah. Any vinaigrette, anytime you're trying to mix together oil and water, you want to add some kind of emulsifier. So mustard is a very common emulsifier. That's what I use in my really simple vinaigrettes. And even a little dollop of mustard is going to help your oil and water mix together better. Egg yolk is a good emulsifier, or even a dollop of mayonnaise. That's actually an even more powerful emulsifier. You can also use sort of thickening agents. So like honey makes a good emulsifier. Chopped nuts can actually even help emulsify salad dressings. This is all very simple and fun to test at home. If you get yourself three plastic deli containers, fill them all with the same amount of oil and vinegar, 3:1 ratio oil to vinegar. One of them leave empty, one of them add a little dollop of mustard, and one of them add a little dollop of mayonnaise, and then shake them all up really vigorously to emulsify and then let them sit. And you'll find the one that doesn't have any mustard or mayonnaise will separate much, much faster. So it'll actually separate in that order. The one with nothing will separate first, then the one with mustard, and then the one with a little bit of mayonnaise. And that's sort of a good indication of how powerful a given emulsifier is going to be.
Now that we know what to do with our dressings, Give us some ideas for salad. Is there a kind of template that we should be thinking of so we can create those kind of, I don't know, Ottolenghi, beautiful salads at a moment's notice?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I always like to think of salads as, well, first of all, having like one base ingredient. So whether that's going to be some really nice lettuce or like a bitter green or like a blanched vegetable, you know, like blanched asparagus or blanched green beans, you always want to have some kind of base ingredient. And then I'll think about complementary flavors, and that one I'll do in a slightly lesser amount. So, you know, in a lettuce salad, that could be like, you know, chopped nuts, or often it's croutons, you know, little pieces of blue cheese, or maybe little bits of goat cheese. It could be some spiced nuts, or it could be dried fruit, like dried cranberries. So, you know, I always like to think of my salads as having a few different components, and each one of them brings a little bit of something to the table, but it doesn't compete. Often you can make a really simple green salad, and that's totally fine too. A roast chicken and like a butter lettuce salad with a really perfect vinaigrette, I think is an excellent meal.
Thank you so much, Kenji.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
That was Kenji Lopez-Alt. His new really fantastic reference book is called The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. Time now for our weekly visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Laura Avery's there now with an update.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm talking with Mike Williams, executive chef at Nora in West Hollywood, which just opened a couple months ago. Mike, you're here at the market. It's kind of a cool, cloudy day. What are you shopping for?
I'm shopping for many things today, but one of them is cauliflower for our vegetable charcuterie plate at Nora.
Okay, two things. Cauliflower is a fairly, I'm going to say, commonplace vegetable. Sure. And number two, charcuterie plate. Mm-hmm. So how does that work together?
Well, at Nora, we do a lot of whole animal butchery at Nora. Thus, we do, you know, your standard pork and meat charcuterie. But being in West Hollywood, we wanted to make sure to have options for everybody. And there are a lot of vegans and vegetarians and people with dietary restrictions. So we wanted to do vegetable and seafood charcuterie as well. And cauliflower tartare is one of the features on our vegetable charcuterie plate.
And when you say charcuterie, what I think of charcuterie is sort of processed. You take the meat or whatever and then you process. So how is the cauliflower processed?
Correct. The cauliflower is, we chop it up finely and then we treat it in two different ways. Some of it we fry to get some nice caramelization on it. And some of them we do more of a fine dice and then saute it till it's still kind of al dente. And it creates a nice texture. The two sort of play off one another.
And you saute it in what?
Grapeseed oil is what we use. And we also, in the final sauce, we mix it with a sort of a tahini sauce, which is a, you know, a sesame paste. And that's got some extra virgin olive oil in it.
So then when you're serving it as charcuterie, is it like in a little pot or something?
We do it in a ring mold to kind of resemble, you know, like a steak tartare. I mean, you could really plate it any way you want to. For the style of plate we have a like a mushroom carpaccio on there. Then we have a chickpea sausage that we do. So the ring mold kind of plays a nice shape contrast to the other items on the plate.
And then I was going to ask what the sides would be with that. Something sweet, something salty.
We do a maple mustard. So instead of honey mustard, we use maple because it keeps it vegan for one, but it also tastes delicious. And we have lots of different house-made pickles. We have pickled okra, a couple different types of pickled cauliflower, pickled onions, two different types of pickled cucumbers. And then we serve it with our house-made Levant bread that's grilled over wood fire. So it's like a nice crusty country bread to have with your charcuterie.
Do you use all the different colored cauliflowers that we have now?
We do, yeah. The white cauliflower is the one we feature in the tartare. And then we use purple cauliflower and golden cauliflower as our pickles that also go on the plate.
And is there a difference in the flavor? I always try to do that blind taste test with the purple cauliflower and the golden and the white. Is there really a taste difference?
Sometimes texturally, they have a little bit of a different thing going. White cauliflower tends to be a little more full and maybe a little more crumbly than some. Sometimes the yellow and purple cauliflower will have a little more texture to the stem. But if given a blind taste test, I don't know that I would pass that one.
Sometimes the cauliflower has a little bit of a peppery taste, too.
Yeah, a nice peppery taste. I mean, a lot of the brassicas have that peppery taste where they, you know, you kind of finish a little spicy, kind of that cabbagey kind of note.
Yeah, especially the fresher it is. I've noticed when you get the stuff here and the cabbage, too, it's when you get a fresh cauliflower, it's a whole different experience than when you get it commercially.
It is. And another thing about the fresh cauliflower is you can use the whole thing from the leaves and the stems and all that. When the cauliflower I get here at the market has beautiful leaves that, you know, we sometimes, if we have too many extra, we'll end up throwing them in our staff meal pasta. But they're just delicious, tender greens. And if you get kind of old commercial cauliflower, it just doesn't have that.
So you saute the outer green leaves of a cauliflower?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. You can julienne them. You can eat them raw. I mean, if you pull them off and taste them, they're tender enough to eat raw. And it has the flavor of cauliflower with just a little bit more moisture in it.
That's great. All right. Well, thank you so much. It sounds like a wonderful combination of the veggie and the meat and cauliflower tartare. Who knew?
Thank you.
That was Mike Williams. He's executive chef at Nora in West Hollywood. And he's creating plates of wonderfulness just using the simple, humble cauliflower. I'm talking with Julia Tamai right now. Julia is a farmer's daughter who grew up at the farmer's market. She's actually third generation. She's back here for a rare appearance at the Tamai Farm Stand. Julia, you are growing a lot of cauliflower among many, many other vegetables up there in Oxnard. Can you tell us a little bit about how you grow it? Is it hard to grow? Is it year-round?
Well, the cauliflower we're growing right now is the cheddar cauliflower, purple cauliflower, and Romanesco. So we have the three varieties and then your standard white, the snow white we grow. We start them out in the nursery. So we have someone we go to back home. They start the little seedling because it's very small. So that's the difficult part. Then once they get a little root in them, we go transplant them into the field. And from there, it takes about 2.5 months to grow, depending on the weather. That's in cold weather. If it's a little warmer, we're looking at 2 months, maybe even shorter than that. They're growing really well. They're coming up fast. The restaurants really seem to like them. The cheddar is obviously the yellow one. That one's going to have a lot more traditional cauliflower flavor. A lot of parents like getting them for their kids because of the color. So they think there's cheese on them already, and then they get a nice surprise. And then the purple one, that one's actually a lot sweeter. So if you've never had that one, that one's a really sweet one. You can eat raw. We like to roast them at home. And then the Romanesco, it almost tastes like a broccoli and cauliflower combined. So that's where it gets that green kind of treetop look.
How do you know as a farmer when the perfect time is to pick a head of cauliflower?
The perfect cauliflower for me would be they'd have a little opening from the leaves, so they wouldn't be completely wrapped and covered. So you'll see a little spot of white. We'll use a white cauliflower, for example. And then you touch the head, and it's got a nice firmness to it, and you can feel the weight. Usually about 4.5 to 6 inches in diameter, and that's when you know you have a really good head there to sell for the market.
People tend to think of cauliflower as being kind of a cold weather crop, so when it gets really hot in the summer, does it kind of tail off a little bit?
It tails off. We stop growing as much just because it starts sprouting and bursting open with the sun, and so when it's that hot, they tend to grow really fast, and then you'll see some of them with the long heads. They have sprouting heads if we let them grow too long.
Okay, well, you're going to have them all year. You've got all the kinds and the Romanesco. So great to know the cauliflower are just such an exciting vegetable.
Thank you.
That was Julia Tamai. She's Gloria Tamai's daughter. We talked about cauliflower, but the Tamai stand is just loaded with tons and tons of greens and vegetables. And of course, in the summer, they do bring that corn. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find Michael Williams' cauliflower tartare recipe on the Good Food blog. If you're like me, you look forward to our visit from Jonathan Gold each week. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and the intrepid eater we depend on here at Good Food. Today's restaurant pick showcases exactly why we love him so much. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Evan.
Where are we headed today?
We are going to San Gabriel.
We're having noodles?
Noodles and dumplings.
Noodles and dumplings.
But mostly dumplings.
What is the place called?
The place is called Long Sing Ji. And if it sounds familiar, there's a reason for it. It's essentially the renamed version of Wang Sing Ji, a place we've talked about on the show a lot of times. Some people were telling me about a new wuxi-style dumpling place in San Gabriel, and I got incredibly excited about it, only to find out that it was the same wuxi-style dumpling place.
What is wuxi style?
Wuxi is about an hour away from Shanghai by train, and Wang Sing Ji, which is the place that Long Sing Ji has replaced apparently, has always been the place where you'd go for xiaolongbao, the soup dumplings, except the wuxi style is everything's a little bit sweeter. My guess is that sugar used to be a sign of wealth back when it was hard to get, and they were sort of displaying it in their foods, but that's just sort of armchair anthropology.
Is the product that they're serving basically the same?
It's basically the same. The cooks in the kitchen are the same. The wait staff is basically the same. When you try to ask, they say, owner, new owner, that's all you get. So we're basically revisiting a place that you've been to before, except the pictures on the walls are different.
So the thing to get is definitely the soup dumpling.
Definitely the soup dumplings. They give you a long paper menu with boxes to tick off. And the specialties are marked with a thumbs up. And you should probably order as many of the thumbs up items as you can, because that's probably the best stuff. So the thumbs up soup dumplings will have the little bit extra sugar in there. The soup is nice, you know, sort of intensely porky, a lot of gelatin in it. And the skins are a little bit thinner than the ones that you get at Din Tai Fung.
What are some of the other thumbs up choices? The whole thumbs up thing intrigues me because it's very strange to me that you would have a menu on which you would have items that wouldn't have a thumbs up.
It saves the servers the infinite job of answering the question, what's good? You just look for the thumbs. The smoked fish, the wuxi smoked fish, is fantastic. It's a little bit chewy, a little bit crispy. The smokiness is intense. It's sweet, almost candied on the outside. It will satisfy every cold smoked fish craving you've ever had. There's crispy eels, which, again, are almost candied. Actually, I won't say they're almost candied. They're candied. So if candied eel is something you've been yearning for, this is the place to get your candied eel. And wuxi spare ribs are famous all over China for good reason. They have integrity to them, a nice chew, but they're also super tender, definitely on the sticky side.
Sounds like a good place to get your sweet, savory stuff on.
Yeah. You are going to get probably the pork dumplings if you're going to get one kind of dumplings, which you're not going to do. You have to get a lot of different kind of dumplings, but the pork ones are the ones to get. There's also pork and crab dumplings. And if you're feeling in a certain mood, they have the giant dumplings.
Like the cat's head dumplings?
They're bigger than that. It comes one to a steamer where it's sort of flattens itself like a water balloon or like a miniature astrodome. And it's a giant soup dumpling. They serve like boba straws with it. And you pierce the surface of the dumpling and you suck out as much of the juice as you can. Because if you try it with a spoon, it's just going to collapse onto the plate underneath.
So this is like a Farrell's ice cream experience, but with a soup dumpling.
Oh, I never thought about that. Is it the soup dumpling equivalent of a Farrell zoo? It could be. Oh, you can stick candles in it for your birthday.
How many people can eat off of one of those?
Four people can, like, share a dumpling. I mean, if you're having other dumplings. If it was your sole lunch, you'd probably want it all to yourself.
Wow.
And then beyond that, there's, you know, nice cold noodles in sesame sauce. There's the beef noodle soup, without which it is impossible to thrive in the San Gabriel Valley.
Is that sweet, too?
No, that's not sweet. Maybe you're going to want some sautéed vegetables. The sautéed string beans are very simple, very good.
Sounds wonderful. Once again, you have made me terribly hungry.
Then I have done my job, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Longxin Ji, which specializes in wuxi-style food in San Gabriel. Text the words good food to 69866, and we'll send you a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Charlene Wang is one of our favorite people to talk about tea with. She's a tea buyer and travels extensively throughout Asia in search of quality leaves. On a recent trip, she stumbled upon a fascinating story in Maesalong, Thailand. It involves Taiwanese oolong tea. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, Evan.
Set the stage for us geographically. Where is the tea-growing region of Thailand in relation to where you would normally find oolong?
Well, oolong can be grown in different places. It's grown in China and it's grown in Taiwan. I mean, it could technically be grown anywhere, but Taiwan is the most famous, I would say, terroir for oolong, fine oolong teas. And that is quite far from Thailand, the country. Taiwan is 1,400 miles from Thailand.
How did it happen that oolong, which is such a prized variety in Taiwan, ended up being grown 1,400 miles away?
So in the late 40s, the Chinese Communist Party and the Kuomintang, also known as the KMT, they were fighting for power and control of China. And there was one detachment based in southwest China in Yunnan, which is on the border of Burma and Thailand. When the communists came to power, this one detachment retreated into Burma because they were on the losing side, basically. And the rest of the Kuomintang, the leadership, fled to Taiwan. But these people were stranded in Burma, and the Burmese government wasn't too happy about an army from another country in their borders, obviously. So they brought it up to the UN in 1953.
And what happened then?
They had an official resolution passed saying they need to either disarm or they need to withdraw their forces. A coalition of governments, Thailand, Burma, America, and Taiwan, all met. And the solution was this army, which was basically refugees now in Burma, were going to go to Thailand and they were going to be repatriated to Taiwan. So that started happening. About 7,000 people went back to Taiwan, but 4,000 people were left in Thailand.
4,000 people?
Yeah, and these are all soldiers, you know, who were kind of left behind. The Thai government came up with a kind of a creative solution. And their solution was, well, if you can help us fight some of our indigenous populations, we'll give you land and you can become citizens here.
So they kind of became mercenaries for the Thai government?
Yes, that is a very succinct way of putting it. They became mercenaries, but they still maintained some connections to Taiwan. And Taiwan started sending aid. They would appropriate some assistance money. And they would start sending people to help them develop some industries to support themselves, because they were in this border hinterland up in northern Thailand, bordering Burma.
The refugees who stayed in Thailand, they were given legal status mm-hmm. in exchange for fighting a tribal group in the region. How did the tea end up over there?
One important thing to note is there is an indigenous tea plants that grow in this region. Like, as you know, in Burmese culture, there's that pickled tea leaf salad.
That's right.
And this is in that same region. But what happened was, when the Taiwanese started sending aid and sending people to help develop agriculture and industries, one of the ideas they came up with was growing tea. So they brought over tea tree saplings to Thailand to grow, and they taught the local communities how to cultivate the tea and how to finish it in the artisanal oolong style.
This is such an interesting and strange story.
I know. It's so fascinating that such a strange little pocket of Asia came about in such an unusual exchange, and it actually was a product of war and refugees, if you think about it. But now it's blossomed into this thriving artisanal tea center.
Thank you so much, Charlene, for bringing us this fascinating story of war and refugees from another time.
Thank you, Evan. I really enjoyed sharing the story with you.
That was tea buyer Charlene Wang. We've been talking about Taiwanese oolong tea grown in Thailand. Charlene's business is Tranquil Tuesdays. I want to give a shout out to the Good Food team for all the hard work that goes into producing this show.
Let's do it.
That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Tse, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and don't forget to share your support with us. Go online to kcrw.com/join or call those magic numbers, 1-800-600-KCRW. That's 1-800-600-5279. And thanks. Truly, we wouldn't be here without you. I'll be back next week with an hour-long show. You won't want to miss it.